And good morning. Welcome to another edition of Health Essentials. It's a beautiful day outside. If you want to know what the number here, if you would like to call in, because I have people call me every week and they say they can't, I mean at the office, and they say they can't get in. So now you have your opportunity. 903-586-5257. This program's called Health Essentials. You know, some things are very easy to talk about, like, for example, this right here. I'm looking at some research on PMS back from the 1980s. And I know what you're thinking. Just because it was done in 1980 doesn't mean it's not valid. Anyway, listen to this right here. This is very interesting. They took a group of women that had PMS, and they said, okay, these women right here, they have what's called idiopathic cyclic edema. That means they've got horrible fluid retention. And I guess it's a matter of where the fluid tends to accumulate and build up that makes a woman miserable. But, for example, what if you notice that right around the time of your period, you had tremendous bloating and swelling in your lower abdomen, and it was to the point that you were just miserable and uncomfortable? Well, listen to this, because I don't think I've ever read this before, or at least I don't remember reading it. It said women that have PMS, they have, I won't use all the medical terms, but they just retain a ton of salt and water, according to study. And so what they did was, 10 of the women were given ginkgo biloba orally, and that's an herbal extract. Ginkgo biloba is a tree. It's a really hardy tree. It's kind of an amazing tree. It lives a long time. It tolerates a lot of abuse, but it keeps on living. That should tell us something. So 10 women were given ginkgo biloba extract, and I think the dose was exactly 40 milligrams three times a day, or they gave 5 of the women an IV with ginkgo biloba, which I don't think I've read that before. This was in 1986. What was the result? Oh, here's the result. The biological anomaly of all the fluid retention, the swelling in the women's bodies with PMS was fully corrected by administration of the extract. That is like wild. How could you write a study and say fully corrected without meaning it was fully corrected? Here's another one right here that I find interesting. This comes from an article written, Clinical Uses of Essential Fatty Acids. It comes from Montreal, Eden Press, 1982. 68 patients, and I like the way they chose these patients right here, with severe PMS. If it says 68 patients with severe PMS, that means that no men were involved in the study, maybe the researchers, but not any men. These were all women. And the reason these women were chosen for this study, they had failed to improve with medication. They also gave them a form of B6 called pyridoxine. Didn't do anything to abate the horrible symptoms of severe PMS. So what they did was, they tried to retool, and they took a step back and said, oh, this is not working, giving women all these drugs, or vitamin B6. How can we reset and retool here? So what they did was, they gave these women, these 68 that failed with medical treatment, they gave them something very, very simple. It comes from a flower. It's called evening primrose oil. They gave them between 1 to 2 grams a day. And what they did was they started 3 days prior to the symptoms onsetting and continuing to the start of menstruation. I don't know how simple I could make this, but they tried to head the symptoms off of the past by giving them some evening primrose oil about 3 days prior to the horrible symptoms starting. And continuing until the start of their flow. Does that make sense? Okay. So you're asking the question, well, how long does it take for something to work? Well, here's the results. 61% of those 68 women that had severe PMS reported full relief. I don't know how you interpret the phrase full relief other than it gave them full relief. 23% had partial relief, which compared to no results at all, that's not bad. It said out of the 36 women that had horrible mastodynia. That just means chest or breast pain. 72% reported full relief and 14% partial relief. And they go through a lot of other, nomenclature here, but the most important thing is evening primrose oil proved to be exactly what the woman needed to change the outcome of the disease process or the inflammation. That's interesting. Here's another one right here. This comes from July 1987. It's called the Journal The Female Patient. I try to read each issue when they come out because women are highly complicated and I need all the study aids I can get. Okay, this is a study right here based on women that have really, really rough, severe PMS. And let me see, here it is right here. 32 women that have severe PMS, and they also had a history of vaginal candidiasis. That means a yeast infection. And previously, in order to be in this study, they had to fail to respond to all sorts of treatments, including vitamin B6. They gave them pharmaceutical drugs to lessen their PMS, and they also gave them psychotherapy, which I don't really know what that entails, but it could be as simple as, let's identify what the problem is, and these might be some solutions to dealing with that problem. Okay, that's just my interpretation. It said that 10 out of the 15 who received a sugar-free, yeast-free diet, and they took the oral nystatin, which is a drug for candida, they had significant relief from their PMS. But it did say that in the control group where they were given plenty of sugar, no change whatsoever. Anyway, that's kind of interesting. So some things, yeah, they're straightforward. They're not hard to think about. They don't really make you double check and go, man, I wonder if I can do that. Well, I mean, for example, if you had horrible PMS and you just heard me talk about the use of evening primrose oil, maybe I'm wrong about this, but that's like an easy step to take. So let's just say today you're going, wow, I'm fixing to start my period, I'm so irritable. Well, you could go to the store instantly and buy evening primrose oil and take it and then see if you're better off for it. And you go, wow, what an amazing God we have. But there are other aspects of healing that are very hard to deal with. And I'd like to cover a little bit of those this morning. And I think you'll know where I'm coming from. In 1982, there was a German study presented at the 4th International Symposium on the Prevention and Detection of Cancer in London. And what they found was there were certain personality traits to have a strong association with breast cancer. So what they did was they had 56 women that had been admitted to the hospital for biopsies in order to be evaluated. And what they did was they evaluated these women that had lumps or tumors growing in their breast. And they wanted to evaluate personality characteristics. Okay? And you're probably wondering what personality characteristics are the researchers looking for. Well, they look for something called emotional suppression. Now, I can give you an idea what that might look like. Let's just say that something happens in a behavior or a conversation with somebody, and you do not like the way it's going, and you feel tense on the inside. You're not enjoying this conversation. It makes you feel downright yucky. But in order to prevent yourself from being ashamed, or there's a lot of dynamics to this, or if you get angry, what you do is you suppress it. You push it down. You don't deal with it. You don't come out and tell the person, you know, what you're saying is not correct, and you're making me feel bad, or this, I feel bad when you say that about me, and that's not true. So instead of confronting the person, you just suppress it. The next characteristic they looked for was rationalization. And you know, you could probably say that a lot of ways also, but let's just say something, a storyline doesn't go exactly the way that you want, but you may kind of in your own mind reconfigure the story to kind of lessen the pain that you're experiencing by the way it turned out in the real world. I mean, I'm sure I've done that before, just like I'm sure I've suppressed emotions. Another emotion they looked for was avoidance of conflict. And depending on how a person's raised, well, my goodness, they may have been beat down an awful lot as a child where it just wasn't, you know, you didn't experience freedom to, you know, cry, for example. I can't even tell you how many people I've heard tell me that they were not allowed to cry as children. I mean, isn't that normal for a child to express emotions, to get angry, to express, you know, grief? And I guess the reason why I'm covering these two is because historically, when you look at surveys, acute grief and anger, they are by far and away the riskiest emotions for a person to exhibit because you get judged by it. And, you know, rightly so. And you would agree with me, there's a good expression of grief and anger, and there's one that's bad. So what they did was they had researchers, just based on interviewing these 56 women that went to the hospital for breast biopsies, and the interviewers and also what were called the blind raters, a second group of people that evaluated the data that it really had no contact with the women whatsoever, they could predict with 94% accuracy out of the 56 women that 94% of them had cancer and 70% of the cases were benign. So they could tell just rating the women's emotions and how they took care of themselves and how they responded to stress, which ones were going to have cancer, but they could also tell which ones were going to be benign tumors. I find that so interesting. Now there's another study. This comes from King's College and Hospital in London, England. And in this study, they were able to show very, very clearly that women with cancerous breast lumps, they characteristically exhibited extreme suppression of anger. And this is compared to the control group that did not have breast cancer, that did not suppress their anger. Here's another one right here. This one kind of blows my mind, but here goes. And of course, they're looking at one unique profession. Now, I'm not trying to say that men can't be great nurses. Of course they can. But I was raised in an era where the vast majority of nurses were women, so you had to cut me some slack. Maybe the tide is turning to where 99.9% of all nurses are men. I don't know. Maybe that's the way the world's going. But when I was younger, I always had this association. I think it's rightly so. It's because of the culture. That if I was going to be seen by a nurse or cared for by a nurse, it was going to be a woman. You know, when I had one of my many accidents. So this comes from the year 2000. There was a publication, it's called Cancer Nursing, and what they did was they surveyed the relationship of anger repression and cancer, and often noted by, among others, the cancer nurses themselves. This is interesting. And they go on to write in the article, somehow nurses had this intuitive understanding that this particular form of niceness that they would exhibit was very deleterious. Okay? What they're saying is, when you're overly nice and you take all the pain and suffering and you're still nice instead of, you know, expressing your emotions, then that can lead to cancer. Here's another one right here. Now, this one is going to be bizarre, but let me have a go at it. There was a research paper on an autoimmune condition that affects the one of the lateral motor, what are they called? Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, but that's like the motor cortex. I may have gotten that wrong. But anyway, you remember there's a disease called Lou Gehrig's disease, like one of the most famous baseball players of all time. He came down with it, or he contracted ALS. But the condition is called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. There were two Cleveland Clinic neurologists, in which the Cleveland Clinic is actually, it's got to be one of the most prestigious medical, you know, groups on the planet. Very famous for cutting-edge research, very famous for trying to figure problems out. Well, they were at this international congress in Bavaria in the 1990s. And this is what they presented, which this is kind of like mind-blowing right here. What they did was they had the staff that made contact with the patient. So if somebody was suspected of having ALS, and they're going to, of course, those people are going to go see a neurologist to receive care, right? Okay. And so long before they see the doctor, they're going to have contact with a receptionist, and they may have another office worker or a nurse that greets them as they enter and helps them with their paperwork and make sure they have all their, you know, ducks in a row before they actually go back and see the neurologist. What they did was they had their staff, and let me just read the article to you. Their staff, too, found that their ALS patients were extraordinarily nice. Now, at first reading, you go, well, what's wrong with being extraordinarily nice? So much so that even their staff could, in the vast majority of cases, they could accurately predict who would be diagnosed with ALS and who would not. Okay, that may be kind of hard to swallow, but here goes. They would have the receptionist write on the chart, and this is what one of the comments the receptionist made. She said, "I'm afraid that this person has ALS. She is too nice," and they would jot it on the patient's file. Or, "This person cannot have ALS. He is not nice enough." And so the neurologists were dumbfounded. And they're going, well, they're not the neurologist. How could my receptionist figure out who has ALS and who doesn't? So in spite of the briefness of the staff's contact with the patients, the obvious unscientific method by which they form their opinions, almost invariably they have proven to be correct. And so they're looking at personality characteristics of people that develop an autoimmune disease called ALS. That means what you do is you're so nice, you kind of start suppressing and repressing your emotions. You don't really deal with them. So you just bury the pain, the suffering deep instead of either confronting somebody or drawing boundaries, if that's the one way that you can think of it. I had a flashback just now. I remember Larry was telling me a story about somebody back in the 1990s, and it was after he and I had been in contact with this person. He said, "Roy, let me teach you something here, you need to learn this." He says, "When people are abnormally nice like that guy just was, and how they were overly complimentary and they were too glowing and nice and sweet," he said, "that's not normal behavior." And that's really all he was trying to say. There's a difference between a normal niceness and then a person that's just abnormally over the top. And of course, I've learned the hard way. When a person is abnormally nice and super complimentary, it's because they want something. They're fake. Anyway, here's another study right here. In a study of men that have prostate cancer, they showed that if they suppressed their anger on these personality questionnaires, it was greatly associated with a diminished effectiveness of natural killer cells. Which, do you know what natural killer cells are? These are the cells that you want to have a bunch of. For example, if you're 96 years old and you're listening to this radio program right now, or you're 98 or you're 100, and you really are strong and you can go to the grocery store and drive yourself and put up your own groceries, and you can mow the grass and do yard work and go to church on Sunday morning, and you can participate in life and care for other people, and you can have fun and enjoy yourself, and you can read and study, well, most likely you have about 10% stronger immune system than those of you that have not made it that far. Because that's one of the distinguishing features they show, that when you get to be 96, 100 years old, or even 90, your immune system works on average about 10% better compared to those that pass away when they're, say, 65. And you know what? These things amaze me. Sometimes I'll look at a person and I can tell exactly what their age is. And sometimes when I look at a person, I really do a double check and I think, okay, what is their age? But then again, because of the severe stress that they've been through. You know, and the truth of it is, stress ages a person so quickly and so badly, it's just so hard on the body, that I can't really tell what their age is. And so I'll say, do you mind if I ask what your age is? And I'll think to myself, oh, they're 70. But when they tell me they're going, I'm 54, I'm going, oh dear, I think there was some stress involved there. But these natural killer cells, these are what you want plenty of, and you want them working and doing their job, because God has designed them to go after cancers and tumors and to remove anything that's not you. From infections to aberrant tissue to a cancer cell that's decided it's going to take over and do whatever it wants, well, you want your natural killer cells. And so men that have prostate cancer in this study, when they have anger that they don't deal with, that's probably the key term right here, then when they measure their natural killer cells, well, they ain't working. And so what would you guess is going to be the problem? Well, the problem is the cancer is going to just go marching right on with nothing to stop it. And so these natural killer cells, they play one of the most major key roles of all time in resisting the development of a tumor. In a previous research, I can't find this one, I just know it was done in Britain, Great Britain, natural killer cell activity was reduced in healthy young people in response to relatively minor stresses. And the one that they picked up on was people that felt like they were emotionally isolated, which they're finding out now, when you feel like you're lonely and isolated, there's your significant source of chronic stress. I know this is easy to say, it's harder to do, but you know how in the book of Proverbs it said, he who would have a friend must first show himself to be a friend? Well, that's true. Sometimes you just have to kind of come out of your loneliness and your isolation. You've got to make contact with somebody. That's just so, so important. I can tell you what you can do tomorrow morning. You can get up and iron your shirt and go to church. See what happens. And actually, you can go with a good reason in mind. I want to learn more about God. I want to worship Him. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Morgan. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Okay. I've got a question. I'm wondering, what foods should I eat to lower my cholesterol?
Well, the Jain study, which is a community from India, they asked the same exact question, and it was just based on identifying one or two things in their diet. And so all they plotted on the scale was how much onion and garlic consumption were these people participating in. And so lo and behold, those that ate the most onions and the most garlic, they had absolutely the lowest cholesterol.
Oh.
So that's one idea.
Okay.
The other thing is, I was going to go on a slight same topic but a different angle. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. This to me is disturbing. And I don't like it, but there's not much I can do about it except I can talk about it. I can try to make people more aware of it. And maybe one day it'll come true. But there's a very simple blood test that can be ordered. And it's a test to measure what's called oxidized cholesterol. And so when I say oxidized cholesterol, you're probably going, well, I don't know what that means. What does that mean for something to oxidize? Well, my example would be if you go to the hardware store and you buy some nails, but you accidentally leave the sack of nails out in the rain and they get wet, what happens if you find them a couple months later? Do they look nice and bright and shiny, or do they look rusty?
No, they're rusty.
Exactly. So the only time that cholesterol really ever can present any health problem is if it begins the process of oxidation. Okay? So one of the things that I have to think of, and a lot of what I'm basing my response to you on is based on just reading so many documents to try to figure this out. And so in simplicity, if cholesterol levels become significantly elevated on a lipid profile, you know, where they measure your LDL, your triglycerides, your total cholesterol.
Yeah, and I have those numbers in front of me.
And so when those become elevated, just throw me a number.
Cholesterol, 243.
What is the LDL?
LDL calculated, 162.
Okay. What does it say about triglycerides?
154.
Okay. So I think we have maybe two or three issues right here, but going back to the idea, the only time that cholesterol can ever present a problem is if it begins the process of oxidation. What that means is it's just resting inside of you. And so resting cholesterol, guess what it does? It loves to glue itself to the inner lining of your arteries and form plaque. Not good. And so in that one study, they showed onions and garlics appreciably lowered a total cholesterol. But doctors today, they don't really measure oxidized cholesterol. So in a roundabout way, there's another test that they do very willingly. It's called a calcium scoring test. And that's probably, in a backhanded way, the most accurate test of all time to determine the health of the arteries of your heart, like the coronary arteries. Because what they do is they take a CAT scan and they measure the calcium. And so when you find plaque in the arteries, it's not 100% cholesterol. I mean, some of it is. A fair amount of it is, but it also has calcification. And so your body is going to calcify anything that's resting in the body. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I know you have never been to church and shaken hands with somebody with severe arthritis, have you? No, I'm just joking. No, but you know what it feels like to feel someone's fingers when they have these calcified hard knots on the joints and the fingers are bent? That's calcification right there.
Okay.
And so in a nutshell, what you're after here is you're trying to do anything that you can food-wise to limit the amount of oxidation in the body. And so here's one sales pitch. The more sugar that you consume, because sugar burns really dirty and it gives off a lot of free radicals. So there's your oxidation right there. So as a general rule, when somebody has elevated cholesterol or in your case, high triglycerides also, there's probably either more sugar consumption that needs to be or a person is overly stressed, which, you know what, technically, I think I'm accurate when I say this, that really, anytime that you're highly stressed, your arteries are resting. I really believe that to be true. Which I think the prize is we want to get to a good place where we're not resting and we're not stressed all the time.
Right.
Or overly stressed, I should say. It's just inconceivable that you're going to not have some stress, right?
Right. Yes.
And so okay. I'm going backwards a little bit further. And so the biggest problem, as I see it, is the problem of when iron begins the process of rusting in the body. And so with men, this is particularly devastating because as they age, they tend to accumulate more iron, which I think if I was to keep going with this line of thinking, it would be so good for you to go and start the process of donating a pint of blood or a gallon. I mean, it just depends on how much they need.
Uh-huh.
You probably have a few extra gallons in your body that you could donate, right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Maybe not at one time, maybe over two different times. But if you donate blood, what you're doing is you're helping rid the body of old iron that's built up in the tissues. And they really don't have a good test for this. I mean, ferritin is sort of fair at times. You can have a ferritin test, and so for men, if ferritin comes back above the number 50, then most likely you got a lot of rust and iron inside of you, and that's going to make your cholesterol oxidize, and cholesterol is going to become elevated trying to counter the rusting.
Okay. Food-wise, other than onion and garlic and eliminating sugar, are there any other foods?
Well, the vast majority of all cholesterol is going to be manufactured in the liver, and eating beef liver is absolutely the greatest thing of all time if a person's willing to do that.
Oh, yeah.
And so I could break it down for you. The minerals that I think are absolutely the most important when it comes to the management of cholesterol, I would say zinc plays a very, very powerful role. And, you know, one of the reasons why I like a lot of the old-time doctors, you know, the MDs from the 20s and the 30s and 40s and before then, is they did not rely on lab tests to do their job for them. They didn't just have a patient come in and go, man, you've got some pretty bad problems. I think we should just watch and wait. That's just ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I hear that. There's not a day that goes by that a patient doesn't make that comment to me, and I just kind of like, I ask them, well, are you happy with that? She says, no, I'm not happy at all about that. I want them to take action. I want them to pursue it. I don't want them to tell me coming back in a year.
Yeah, a lot of times they'll make the statement of, well, let's try this.
Yeah, and that's another way to kind of, and I'm not saying this being dismissive, but this is almost borderline trivial when it comes to addressing the real underlying problem of just giving a drug. Anyway, so so one of the things that you're looking at doing here, food-wise, is you're looking at, well, you said food. I'm switching to minerals. I'm so sorry. I kind of changed the topic on you. Okay, so zinc plays a role, but the old-time doctors, what they would do is they would always look at what's called the zinc-to-copper ratio. And when that starts to get out of balance on a hair analysis, you see cholesterol form in plaque in the arteries, just like if you do a... you know, the test you're talking about, a lipid profile where they measure total cholesterol and HDL and LDL and triglycerides. Well, there's usually another one in there. It's called VLDL. That stands for very low density lipoprotein. Have you heard of that one?
No.
Well, if yours happens to be on there, Dr. Linus Pauling found that when the VLDL starts going 21 or above, that would be one indication that plaque is forming at a faster rate in the arteries than your body's ability to remove it.
Oh, okay.
And so the other test that you could also order is just a simple one. It's called homocysteine.
Okay.
So homocysteine is actually 40 times more predictive than the lipid profile is if you're going to have a cardiovascular issue. See, I like it that you're asking me about lowering cholesterol, but homocysteine is one of the most accurate tests of all time, and anybody can order that anytime they want.
How do you spell it?
Homocysteine? I'm going to have to spell it out first. Homo, H-O-M-O, C-Y-S for cis, and then teen is T-E-I-N-E, H-O-M-O-C-Y-S-T-E-I-N-E. And as a general rule, there's not one test out there that tells a person if they're going to have Alzheimer's. All what they can do is they can do an MRI after they've developed it, and the radiologist can say, well, compared to age-matched controls that don't have Alzheimer's or dementia, your hippocampus is exactly 18% smaller than theirs. Therefore, you have Alzheimer's. But when homocysteine starts getting above 7.7, as that number goes higher and higher, the tendency or the likelihood of predicting Alzheimer's goes up exponentially.
Okay.
Which is another. I know this sounds simple, but under normal circumstances, what happens if you go 3 days in a row without drinking any water? What happens?
You get dried out.
Yeah.
Dehydrated.
And when you get dry, you die. You got to make your mama cry, and she's going to say bye-bye. but if you don't drink water, and it's just the idea and the principle of it, you've got to completely be willing to replenish that which your body uses, and your body uses water, just like your body uses protein and fat and carbohydrates. So you have to replenish them daily. Minerals are the same way, and so are vitamins. Once your body uses zinc and it's done, it's used up. You got to replenish it. Does that make sense?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So I have seen many people that zinc and copper can fix a lot of those issues. And one of the big sales pitches that I have for you anytime a person's lacking in copper, they're going to start rusting big time. Because one thing that bioavailable copper does, it pushes out old toxic iron that builds up in the system. And that's really, really important. Now, I don't know what your age is, and I'm not going to ask. You can tell me if you want to, but if you're a man, you haven't had one menstrual cycle. You haven't had right. one way to wash out old iron. But so for you, if you're not used to giving blood, that's probably one of the best pieces of advice that I could give you. And plus, the Carter Blood Center, they give me $400 cash reward for each victim. No, I'm joking. That's a joke. But if you were to go down there, no, what you're doing is you're giving it not only to benefit, you're the one that wins the most, but you're also helping people because blood really has a short lifespan. I don't think they can keep it very long. You know, what does the Bible say about the life being in the blood?
Yeah. Well, are there minerals or something that I can take to get that copper?
Well, it would be a copper supplement. I mean, to me, the greatest source of copper from any food on the planet comes from one source. And one source only, but I can tell you right now, you're going to reject me because everybody else does too. Nobody will follow my suggestions. I'm just joking about that, but it's beef liver. Beef liver has more copper. It's so valuable. I mean, you got to set your mind that, you know, this is a substance that's so good for me. But if you eat beef liver, that's the greatest source of copper that I'm aware of.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It was very informative. I got all this written down in my notes, and I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for your phone call, and have a great weekend, sir.
Yeah. Are all these, one last question, all these suggestions, and is that good for women also?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I mean, we're all living mammalian organisms. We all are composed of cells and glands and tissues. But all these things are variable, and what I mean by that is some people, they might be blessed just a little bit more genetically. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
I was reading the story in the book of Genesis last night, and it was a story of Isaac. And so he goes to his father-in-law, Laban, and he says, "You want to know what I'm willing to work for wages? I will work 7 years for your daughter, Rachel." And on the wedding night, guess what Laban does? He gives the older daughter, Leah, to him instead. And he wakes up and he goes, "What's the deal here?" But anyway, and I'm not trying to make a joke about that, but what it said was, it says Rachel, he loved Rachel, and she had a very pleasing figure. I hope I'm wording that correctly, and that she was beautiful, but it said about Leah that she had weak eyes. Now, if that's the first time you've heard that a woman has weak eyes, how would you interpret that? I know what I think of in my mind. I think of a woman with eyes that are not... I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I would think maybe not... having the eyelids fully open, but maybe just kind of drooping halfway.
Yes, her nickname was Droopy. But anyway, but you would start to think that maybe she wasn't as blessed genetically, is my point I was getting to.
Right.
And so she might have a little bit of a weakness. And so that's just the way it is in this world. People have strengths, and they also have weaknesses. And
that's
some
right.
people are just genetically superior. It's disgusting. They could go and eat a Frito pie chili cheese dog, and they could... did I tell you the story when I used to run track in high school?
No.
The guy that would always win the 800 meters, he would always beat me. I could never beat him. And I'd look around the field house, and Jason was back there smoking three cigarettes or four before every race. And I'm going, this is not fair. I'm not smoking, and he's smoking like a chimney, and he can still run. Man, do you know how fast that is? If I ran it in like in, let's just say 155, 156, but he runs it in 150, you know how far ahead he is to be six seconds? It's just like, what am I on, a tricycle? But it was just amazing how, and I thought to myself, this is not right. He's abusing his body, but he runs like the wind. And you know what? It just begs the question, what would his potential have been to run like the wind had he not been smoking a pack of cigarettes before every race?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Anyway, but everybody has strengths and weaknesses, and you're trying to learn yourself. But I would say, if it was me, I would pay very, very close attention to magnesium, cod liver oil, and copper. Because just about all the modern food is just so deficient in magnesium, copper, and essential fatty acids.
Right.
And so it's not like you're running through the forest every day with your spear and your team of hunting dogs looking for wild boar. Or are you?
No.
Okay.
No. Okay. Or at least not today.
Well, the night's still young. You know what? There was the coolest big yellow moon when I drove in. It was awesome. Perfect for hunting wild boar with your spear.
Well, maybe I'll give that a shot tomorrow morning.
I think should.
It's Sunday. It's Sunday, so.
Oh, that's right. The Lord's Day. You got to get ready for church, right?
Yep.
I mean, who wants to show up with blood on your hands, right?
Yeah. Well, okay. Dr. Morgan, I thank you, and
you're
I
welcome.
Appreciate it, and pray that you have a great day.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
All righty. If you would like to join me on the radio, there's a phone line once again open, 903-586-5257. That is 903-586-5257. Okay. Here we go. What they did was they did an experiment on laboratory mice in the year 2013. And what they did was, instead of using human beings for the study, they chose to use mice, which I think is like a good call. I'm not for abusing mice, but I mean, come on. I don't want to abuse human beings and put them under stress. So what they did was, they subjected mice to pretty significant stress, which is meant to mimic what human beings go through. Well, somebody's calling. We'll come back to this. Good morning and welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Thanks. Thanks for your call. How are you today?
You're welcome. Thank you. I want to ask you a question about tinnitus.
Okay.
Is there anything you can do that will help that?
Okay. I think you have your radio on the background, but anyway, I can hear the reverberation in my ear.
I do. I'm sorry.
I can barely stand to hear myself talk once, but to hear myself talk five times in reverberation. Okay, so tinnitus, and what I'm going to do is let me just kind of go through this with you right here. There's a lot of potential reasons and causes for it, and so let me just kind of break it down. Is that okay with you?
Yes.
Okay, I saw a gentleman recently who told me, he said, Dr. Morgan, he said, I need help. He said, this is the most annoying thing that I have to deal with. He said it's particularly bad at nighttime. He said, I think as long as I stay busy during the day and I have all this background noise, it's annoying, but not like at nighttime when I'm alone with myself. You know what I mean by that?
I do.
And so when I examined him, the top thing that came up was that he had a low-grade fungus or candida infection in his ears. And so I told him, I said, listen, I know this sounds weird, but I need to treat you as if you have a candida infection. So I think one of the things I had him do was just cut out all sugar. And I think we chose maybe a few nutritional remedies. I think one of them was like lactic acid yeast. I may have used a detoxifying herb or plant called Spanish black radish, and I'm sure I used a few other things to help him. But I didn't hear from him for like 3 months, and when he came in, he said, man, I forgot to tell you, my tinnitus is 100% gone. I'm going, way to go, dude, that was great. And of course, I like it when things work out well like that. And so let me go on to the next one. If you look at the studies on tinnitus or damage to the ear, there was a lot of research done back in the 1920s and the 1930s on a vitamin called vitamin A. Vitamin A is a fat-soluble vitamin, so you'll get some when you eat, you know, sweet potatoes, or you have mangoes, or you have carrots. Beef liver is by far and away the largest source. But if a person is really low in vitamin A, they are probably most prone to ear problems and ringing in the ear. So that might be one thing that you might consider. And so, just like the previous gentleman caller, I told him that liver has the greatest copper amount of all time. Well, guess what has the greatest vitamin A amount of all time? Liver. And so that's another one. So going on to point number three, it can be that the circulation to your ear is just not as good as it used to be. And so there are studies that demonstrate that increasing blood flow to the ear can help diminish tinnitus. And so there's an herb called ginkgo biloba. There's another one that's used as a spice called cayenne pepper. The cayenne pepper is a very, very interesting substance. It's probably like underutilized. I probably underutilize it. But sometimes it does a remarkable job at helping to improve blood flow to the ears. I'm a fan of ear candling just to see if that helps. If you don't know how to do it, you can go to YouTube. You've probably never heard of that website. I'm the only one that has. I'm just joking. But you could probably look up a video on how to candle the ears, and it would probably be... Oh, you have?
I've done it, yeah.
Well, what came out?
Oh, some. Some.
Okay.
Not a whole lot, but there was some that came out.
There's a class of drugs. Some are by prescription, but most are over-the-counter. They're called NSAIDs. That stands for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. You ever heard of those?
Oh, yeah.
So you got your Aleve, you got your Tylenol, there's ibuprofen. What else did I mention,
Naproxen sodium.
There you go, naproxen sodium, aspirin. You could just keep going, but if those exhibit toxicity, the end result is the toxicity is ringing in the ears. And so for some people, that's really a problem. Now, the reason I brought up vitamin A is because I wanted to bring up my next point, which is magnesium. Because in the presence of a vitamin A deficiency, the ear just, it becomes inflamed. But magnesium is the same way. There are plenty of studies that show if there's an issue with or deficiency of magnesium, you can experience tinnitus because of that. And then the next thing that I think is toxic is probably aluminum. If you go to the store and they say Mrs. Sasquatch antiperspirant guaranteed to work, don't buy it. Because it contains a boatload of aluminum, and that's what they're using to suppress the production of sweat. Which, you're a lady, you probably don't sweat at all.
Yeah, I do.
Oh, okay. But if you do see a brand called Mrs. Sasquatch, don't get that one, okay?
Okay.
I really just made that up. You can't tell, can you? But anyway, they contain aluminum, and aluminum toxicity is always associated with ringing in the ears. And so if you went to the doctor and had a blood test, there's one marker on the simple complete blood count called HCT. And so there are studies that show that when HCT goes above the number 44, there's a correlation with tinnitus, and this is only example. And if the young man is listening, I'm not picking on him. I love him. He's fabulous. But the last guy I saw yesterday evening before I left for the day, he had a drop of blood form on his leg. And guess what color the drop of blood was?
I think it'd be red.
His wasn't. His was black. And I told him, I said, you know what that means? He says, what? I said, that means, you know, your blood's too thick. You don't have enough oxygen. But like you said, you answered correctly, and it should be red, because usually when your blood is holding generous amounts of oxygen, it's bright red like pomegranate juice. But his is kind of black. Anyway, it's not a slam to him. He's a great guy, and he's coming a long way. But you don't want your blood being thick, so if you look at that marker called HCT or hematocrit, if it starts going above 44, that may mean that we might need to start cleaning the blood. And it's everything that I told the gentleman about just a while ago. So there we go. We reduce toxicity, get rid of naproxen sodium. Well, I can't tell you to get rid of that, but is that what you're taking?
That's what I take for another problem I have.
Yeah, but that's what I was getting to. It can cause tinnitus.
Well, that's not what caused it. A girl, I lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico for 5 years, and the climate was too dry. And my...
Did you say people's personalities were too dry?
That was the first time I've ever had any problem with my ears. It's just one ear. But anyway, there for a while, I would have to go to the doctor and have that earwax come out, you know. So, anyway, when I moved to Colorado, that continued. And then I moved back to Texas.
But it's just the one ear canal?
It's just the one.
Well, that means there's an infection. There's an infection in there then. It's a low-grade infection.
Well, I went back to the doctor. I went to the doctor to have it cleaned out, and this girl came to the house, and that was supposedly her job. And she, I told her, I said, I've had quite a bit of earwax, and she just went about 4 or 5 times, and instead of just the minute she got that wax out stopping, she didn't. And from then on, and I went back to the doctor, and he just said, I don't see anything, I think it's okay.
Well, he's not the one experiencing the tinnitus, is he?
No, he isn't.
Pretty easy for him to say. Well, and what I'm suggesting is if you have one ear that's fine and one ear that's not, that's why I led with a story about the man with candida, because he reported back to me that all the tinnitus went away. And so you've got to come to terms with, if you have excessive wax that builds up in one ear canal, what's the whole purpose of wax? It's to help trap and bind infections. And so if there's no infection, you're not going to have a boatload of wax. Or you could start your own candle-making company.
Well, I haven't had to have my ears cleaned out for quite a while, but I still have the tinnitus.
Well, you can always, the ball is in your court. You can always go back to the doctor and say, is there anything that you can pursue to figure this out? Or you can go somewhere else. But the bottom line is, you have to be your own best advocate, which is what you're doing, so you're in charge of this. So what's your plan? We got to come up with something different. And so I've tried to lay out step by step some things you can look at.
Okay.
So you're saying that naproxen sodium has nothing to do with this. How do you know that?
Well, I don't know that.
Well, and I'm just saying, be open to the idea that one of the side effects is it causes toxicity and tinnitus.
Well, I didn't know that.
Well, and that's why I'm telling you.
Oh.
I mean, that's my job. So I've tried to lay out several things that you can take a look at, and hopefully those will help a lot.
Okay. All right, well... Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I hope you have a great day.
Thank you. I hope you do, too. Love
Thanks. Thank you much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. There's plenty of time for another phone call, 903-586-5257. Here we go. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Morgan. I was wondering... what can you do for, like, swollen ankles and swollen feet? The doctor wants to prescribe, like, hydrocortisone, but, you know...
Are you calling for a friend, or is this for somebody else?
It's for my mother.
For your mother? Okay. How old is she?
She's 68.
I know this is not completely relevant, but the first article that I began with this morning came from 1986, and they were dealing with just horrible edema in the legs of women with PMS. And I know this sounds weird, but they gave intravenous ginkgo biloba, and they fully responded to it. All the swelling went away, which I'm not saying we should give your mom an IV of ginkgo.
Okay. Right.
Okay, wait, I am saying that. We should put her near a tree and just drip it right from the tree into her. No. But they gave him ginkgo and the fluid and went away. But if she has a... Can I just make some guesses here?
Yes.
Okay, one thing that you could do is you could go get one of those pulse oximeters. I think I've seen them for sale for $14 on Amazon before. When they first came out, they were like $300, cutting-edge technology, but now you can buy them for $14. Or if you get the top of the line, maybe $18.95. But a pulse oximeter does a very good job of measuring the heart rate and the percentage of oxygen at the fingertip. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so usually the problems that I see are when the oxygen starts going 94, 95, 96 consistently. Anything below that, they're just not getting enough blood flow or oxygen to their feet.
Okay.
The old time doctors from like 100 years ago, they would discuss a topic called the thoracic pump. And so you know what the heart is as a pump? When the ventricles contract, they push oxygen-rich blood straight from the lungs down toward the toes or the ankles. And if I was guessing right now for your mother-in-law, it's did you say mother or mother-in-law?
Mother.
Okay, sorry about that. So for your mama, it probably takes 20, 21, 22 seconds for the blood to get from the heart down to the toes. It just takes a while. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The very thing that really works to her benefit to get all the fluid back is her thoracic pump, and that's her diaphragm. There's a book called The Breathing Cure. It's not the only one. I mean, there are literally 30 books right now. If I went to Amazon.com just as a reference point and typed in books for breathing exercises, what they would do is they would train you how to regain the ability of your thoracic pump to work properly. But I have seen that work over and over and over again. Once the diaphragm comes back online, all the fluid mysteriously disappears in the legs and the ankles because you regain the efficiency to pump the fluid off your ankles. And that's called the thoracic pump. It just means the efficient working of the diaphragm. It's really amazing. It's God's design.
Yes, sir. All right.
So, it's almost free.
So I should get her some ginkgo biloba or biloba.
Yeah, you could get her some ginkgo if you wanted to. I always think with swelling in the legs, you've got to look at magnesium. Yeah, I'm just not even doing it justice. The last time that I checked, and I know I read this over and over again, I disagree with it, though. They'll say, and you look at experts, and they'll say there's like 585 reactions that depend upon magnesium. Well, I think it's almost 3,800 now that they figured out these are different body processes. In order for them to take place and to be good, you got to have magnesium to make them work right. So there's a lot of stuff that depends on magnesium, and so what that means is without magnesium, your blood vessels tend to kind of leak fluid a little bit. But then again, that's one of the reasons why you should eat blueberries, and you should have cherries, and all sorts of good stuff like that. Green tea, pomegranate's wonderful. Pomegranate's great for the blood.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much.
And you're welcome. Thank you so much, ma'am. I appreciate you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, I think we just have like a moment or two. I'm going to finish this study for you right here. What they did was, instead of using humans to put them under great stress, they took advantage of some mice. I don't know if the mice gave full disclosure and signed contracts, but they were in this study anyway. So in 2013, they subjected mice to 3 weeks of stress, which was meant to mimic the diversity of stressful events in the daily human life. And what that meant for them was they immersed the mice in cold water, they wafted, that's right, wafted predator odors in their direction. They're going, oh man, I smell a cat. They made them endure bright lights or restraint or isolation. And they just gave them stress they couldn't easily adapt to. And the researchers call this chronic variable stress. the mice that were so exposed were found to be an elevated risk for pathogenic autoimmunity. So in a nutshell, this is just another experiment to illustrate that when you're under stress, it wrecks you.